Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Charlie Richardson of the group Military Families Speak Out, who talks about his group's support for U.S. forces fighting in Iraq and their continuing campaign to bring the troops home now. Attorney Bruce Bentley of the National Lawyers Guild, who takes a critical look at police tactics used in the mass arrests of protesters at the Republican National Convention in New York City, and Scott Klinger of United for a Fair Economy, who examines data recently released by the U.S. Census Bureau indicating that the number of Americans living in poverty and without health insurance increased last year. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In late August, the Supreme Court of Chile stripped former dictator General Augusto Pinochet of his immunity as a former president. Pinochet is charged with massive human rights abuses in the 1970s and 1980s. In a split 9-8 decision, Chile's highest court overturned an earlier ruling which stated that the 88-year-old retired general was too ill to stand trial due to his suffering from a mild case of dementia. However, Pinochet appeared well enough to give a lengthy TV interview with a Miami-based station last year, where the former dictator proclaimed his innocence in violating human rights. According to the Interpress agency, Pinochet could face charges filed by the families of 19 victims of Operation Condor, a joint effort by several South American military regimes in the 1970s, to pursue, kill, or disappear leftist opponents in Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Paraguay, and Uruguay. In recent weeks, Pinochet has faced other legal problems, including being questioned about money being held for him in the scandal-plagued Riggs Bank of Washington, D.C. According to the London-based Independent newspaper, the banking scandal could implicate Pinochet in corruption, money laundering, and possibly drug trafficking. Judge Juan Guzman, who is investigating charges relating to Operation Condor, must now reopen the Pinochet file, and his likely first step will be a new health exam for the former dictator. Critics of the World Bank were not surprised when in early August its executive board decided to largely ignore the recommendations of its three-year extractive industries review that called for a funding phase-out of oil and coal projects in the developing world. According to the website oneworld.net, the review conducted by former Indonesian Environment Minister Amil Salim was undertaken to examine the poor record of oil, coal, and mining industries in reducing poverty in nations like Nigeria, Indonesia, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. World Bank President James Wolfensohn, in commenting on the decision to maintain investment in oil and coal projects, observed that 1.6 billion people in poor nations do not have electricity, and over 2 billion people rely on biomass for cooking and heating, a practice that harms human health and the environment. In response, critics say that the World Bank's rhetoric rings hollow, as Keith Slack of Oxfam declared, "Despite its mandate to reduce poverty, the World Bank has been unable to demonstrate that its extractive projects have done so." A consultant who worked on the three-year policy review noted that the bank does not like outside criticism. He added, "The World Bank has really developed, to an art form, high-minded ways of saying that the review's conclusions were misguided." Last fall, Aisha, a community college student in Brooklyn, New York, along with her year-old son, became homeless to escape her abusive husband. While trying to maintain her studies, Aisha was forced to live in New York City's infamous emergency assistance unit, where she had to sleep on benches. Even after she got a spot in a family shelter in Queens, Aisha's life and community college education were in turmoil. She rode the subways for nearly 8 hours a day, going from the shelter to a babysitter and to classes in Brooklyn. After missing her share of classes, she confided to her professors that she was homeless. According to the Progressive magazine, there is a growing underground population of homeless college students, some of whom sleep in cars or in an office of a sympathetic professor. Yet neither the federal government nor most colleges keep a tally of homeless college students. In Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Mary Giesing, a counselor at Kirkland Community College, says she runs into two or three homeless students, usually single parents, every semester. Some have become homeless by leaving an abusive partner, while others have lost jobs, child support payments, or suffer from substance abuse. As Barbara Duffield of the National Association for the Education of Homeless Children and Youth adds, people have this you-can-pull-yourself-up-by-your-bootstraps attitude about college. There is a real gap between the myth and the reality for those who are trying to overcome poverty by getting an education. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.
In the fall of 2002, Nancy Lesson and her husband Charlie Richardson attended an anti-war rally in Washington, D.C. Their son was a Marine who would soon be deployed to Iraq. They met another military family opposed to the war and co-founded the group Military Families Speak Out to give voice to the families who would bear the brunt of U.S. policy in the Middle East. Since then, 1,600 families have joined, including 30 whose loved ones died in Iraq and at least one family whose son committed suicide upon his return from the war. The group states that while many die on the battlefield, there are many more who die in their souls. MFSO has supported the family of Camilo Mejia, an Army reservist who served in Iraq and refused to return there when ordered, citing crimes and abuse committed against the Iraqi people. He is currently serving a year in prison for desertion. Lesson and Richardson have spoken at rallies and conferences nonstop for the past 22 months, condemning the war and demanding that the troops come home now. 1,000 U.S. troops have now died in the Iraq War, while an estimated 10,000 have been injured. The death toll of 66 in August was the highest monthly toll since May, while the 1,100 injured in August is the highest monthly toll of the entire war. Estimates of the number of Iraqi civilians who have died so far range from 10,000 to 40,000. Military Families Speak Out says the war is a tragedy for all who have been put in harm's way. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with MFSO's Charlie Richardson soon after the Institute for Policy Studies announced that his group would receive the Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Award, named after two human rights champions assassinated by the regime of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Richardson talks about the White House rationale for the war in Iraq and how families who felt they needed to support the war in order to support their own sons and daughters fighting in Iraq have come to change their views.
The thing that really strikes me about all of this, or one of the things that really strikes me, is this idea that there is a discrete number of terrorists in the world, and if we can just get rid of them, then we'll be safe. And so by fighting the war in Iraq, they're all going to Iraq, you know, for the big showdown at the OK Corral, and if we just win that, then somehow the world is going to be safe. I mean, it is just an imbecilic view of the world, of terrorism, of how people operate, and what creates the fear and loathing that exists around the world.
How do you approach people who may support the war and feel that it's a good mission and it's a sacrifice worth making? How do you convince them that the war is not a sacrifice worth making and it's more worthwhile to try to end the war and bring the troops home?
I think that the administration has constructed a very tall edifice based on fear, and based on the sort of threat that if you don't support the war, you're not supporting the troops. And so that combination, fear of terrorism, fear of the world, and this idea that you're unpatriotic and unsupportive of the troops, if you even raise any questions, has created this huge rift in the American population. And the problem is people can't even ask simple questions without causing tremendous cracks in that wall. And so you see people who are ignoring the reality that is in front of them. We talk to people all the time who have loved ones in the military who really can't figure out how to deal with their questions about the war. It's easier for them to accept the administration's line. It's easier for them to just say, well, the war must be right because my loved one is at risk. Once they start really asking those questions, they very quickly move to an understanding that this war is wrong and that they need to do something. They have to do something. They can't stand by and watch their loved ones put at risk. They have to do something to try and stop it.
When you call for bringing the troops home, do you mean bring them home tomorrow or bring them home as soon as can be done, which is sort of vague and undefined?
We say very clearly bring them home now, meaning, you know, we understand as well as anybody that the decision to bring them home can be made today, but the troops aren't going to be back home tomorrow. The Iraqi people are not going to wake up and look around and say, hey, where did all the Americans go? It takes a long time to safely remove troops from a country. However, what we believe very strongly is the decision has to be made to bring the troops home. The intent has to be there to bring the troops home. And we want that decision to be made right now and to be announced.
Then I imagine you aren't very optimistic about either of the major candidates because neither one is saying anything like what you're demanding.
That's right. The decision to go to war was taken by the Bush administration, but it was certified and supported by a bipartisan vote of Congress. We haven't heard much from very many politicians who want to end this war and end it quickly. When people start talking about a war that's going to go on for 10 years or 4 years, or, you know, our loved ones continue to die, and it's easy for them to talk in those kind of numbers. It's frankly not very easy for us to hear that. We also don't think that there's any good outcome possible from continuing this war. At this point, the occupation of Iraq is the problem. It's not the solution. We need to commit to bringing the troops home, to getting our troops out of there and to ending the occupation. The reality is politicians have never ended wars. Social movements have ended wars. And the idea that we can depend on any of the politicians to make the right decision here, it's just not the way it happens. It's not the way it happened during the Vietnam War, and it's not going to be the way it's going to happen here. Regardless of who's in political power, their feet are going to have to be held to the fire to end this war.
That was Charlie Richardson of Military Families Speak Out. Call the group at area code 617-522-9323 or visit their website at www.mfso.org. The Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Award will be presented on September 30th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., to Military Families Speak Out, as well as to journalist Seymour Hersh for exposing the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. The day before Republicans gathered in New York City for their national convention, more than 500,000 citizens opposed to the Bush administration participated in a massive legal demonstration, the largest protest ever at a U.S. political convention. While the GOP heard endless speeches and nominated George Bush for re-election, many thousands of activists took part in smaller, more militant actions targeting President Bush's decision to wage war against Iraq and his economic, social, and environmental policies. During the course of the week, police arrested 1,821 protesters, reporters, and innocent bystanders in sweeps launched against dozens of demonstrations and civil disobedience actions. Many of those arrested for minor charges were taken to a city-owned warehouse at Pier 57, dubbed by detainees as Guantanamo on the Hudson. Some detainees complained that while at the detention facility, they were exposed to toxic waste that caused burns and respiratory problems. Civil liberties groups charged that the New York City police unnecessarily held those arrested for excessive periods of time. A deliberate policy, some activists say, which was implemented to keep protesters off the streets until after the GOP convention concluded. Hundreds of protesters were released from custody on the last day of the convention after New York Superior Court Justice John Cataldo threatened to fine the city $1,000 for every detainee held past 5 p.m. Adding to the concern of those observing the protests and police reaction were the comments of New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who likened protesters who shouted at Republican delegates to terrorists. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with attorney Bruce Bentley, the National Lawyers Guild's RNC Mass Defense Coordinator, who takes a critical look at police tactics used in the arrests of protesters in New York City.
The total for the week, according to the police department, is that 1,821 people were arrested. And again, this is more than any other political convention. And of those, 1,480 were arrested for violation. And the most common violation was disorderly conduct. Typically, for allegedly blocking a sidewalk or blocking a street.
How would you characterize the numbers of arrests and how and why these arrests were made, given the civil liberties aspect here of citizens' right to be in the street to vocalize dissent against political powers that be?
Well, what was disturbing is that there were several instances where people were participating in a protest lawfully and peacefully on a sidewalk. In some instances, they were planning to walk on the sidewalk to another location to have a rally or to have some other form of protest. And what we saw that is unprecedented as far as New York City was mass arrests of people on the sidewalk. One instance was on August 31st at a vigil that was organized by the War Resisters League, where people had lined up ready to begin a funeral procession on the sidewalk. And the police, first in directing people to stay out of the street and on the sidewalk and to line up. When people followed that direction, the next thing they heard was an order to arrest everyone. And at that point, the police blocked both ends of the group of approximately 200 to 300 people and used plastic orange netting to literally sweep people into a smaller area as they proceeded to arrest everyone within that area, including three of our legal observers. The National Lawyers Guild had recruited approximately 600 people who volunteered to be legal observers, and on any given day we had up to 300 out in the streets, clearly identified with neon green hats, identifying them as National Lawyers Guild legal observers. And we had, during the week of protests, nearly 15 arrests of our legal observers.
Bruce, there's a theory out there by some protest organizers that, as has happened in other cities around the country with large-scale protests, the police, regardless of civil liberties concerns, arrest many people to keep them off the street for the duration of the event, in this case the convention. So do you think that particular mindset was at work here in mass arrests and trying to keep people off the street?
Well, personally, I'm always reluctant to attribute motive unless I have very clear evidence, and I was reluctant to make any kind of conclusion initially that the police were somehow intentionally trying to keep people off the streets. But what became very apparent is what happened with people once they were arrested, and particularly in response to the 1,100 people arrested on Tuesday, August 31st. Under New York case law, a person who is arrested must be brought before a judge within 24 hours after the arrest. However, for those people arrested on Tuesday, August 31st, that 24-hour period passed and they were still in custody, hundreds of people, so that by Thursday, September 2nd, there were still probably nearly 500 people in custody. Lawyers from the National Lawyers Guild brought a petition for a writ for habeas corpus to try to get these people out. I mean, we're talking about people charged with serious felonies not related to protests who were getting out faster than people being held only on the charge of disorderly conduct, which is not a crime but a violation. It became all the more apparent that the police had slowed down the whole process of bringing these people either before a judge for arraignment or issuing what's called a desk appearance ticket for them to return to court. And it was so evident that finally Judge Cataldo, who was hearing petitions brought both by guild lawyers and lawyers from the Legal Aid Society, after repeatedly directing the city's attorneys to produce these people for processing, found the city in contempt as of, I believe, 5 p.m. on Thursday, September the 2nd, and fined the city $1,000 for each person who was still in custody from previous Tuesday. And at that point, there was approximately 470 people still in custody.
Well, in your mind, is there any kind of legal remedy that would prevent a city such as New York from conducting policing actions the way they have here and in other places in the future?
Well, another course to go, but it requires a careful review by our lawyers, is whether there are some police practices where there's a pattern of practices, such as perhaps the mass arrests that were being conducted of people standing lawfully on sidewalks, that if we were able to make a case seeking injunctive relief to try to prevent the police department from using this in the future. But it's still too early as far as determining whether there's a basis for doing that. So if we, in reviewing the practices that went on, and we're still in the kind of the investigation stage of things, find that there are practices that are not lawful, then we will definitely be looking seriously into bringing litigation to challenge that.
That was attorney Bruce Bentley of the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Call the guild at area code 212-679-6018. Or visit the group's website at www.nlgnyc.org. While the Republican National Convention was underway in New York City last week, the U.S. Census Bureau reported that the number of Americans living in poverty increased by 1.3 million last year, while the numbers of citizens without health insurance grew by 1.4 million. Alarmingly, children were among the hardest-hit segments of the population, with an increase of about 800,000 living in poverty during 2003. In all, almost 13 million of those under the age of 18 now live below the poverty line. Nearly 45 million, or 15.6% of Americans, do not have health insurance. This was the third consecutive rise in these numbers from the Census Bureau, which indicate growing income inequality. Critics of the Bush administration accused the Census Bureau of releasing the data earlier than usual to diminish the impact on the November election, a charge denied by Census Director Lewis Kincannon, a Bush appointee. The Bureau's statistics could be important in this presidential election year, serving to focus public attention on the failure of President Bush's economic policies. During Mr. Bush's administration, 4.3 million Americans have slipped into poverty, and 5.2 million have lost their health insurance coverage. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Scott Klinger, co-director of United for a Fair Economy's Responsible Wealth Project, about the census data and his own group's study of the rise in salaries of CEOs whose companies outsource U.S. jobs overseas.
Really, for the last two decades, we've seen a widening gap between rich and poor, but it's really accelerated over the last 4 years. The Census Bureau found that 12.5% of Americans, that's 35 million people, live in poverty. The striking thing to think about this Labor Day is that 7 million of those 35 million work. So they're people that that work hard. They pursue what we think of as the American dream, and they still show up every night at home, and they can't put food on their plates, and many of them can't put shelter over their heads. So that's something to be mindful of. When we look at the statistics by race, it's even worse. 24% of African Americans live in poverty, 22% of Hispanic Americans. The kids of those racial groups live in poverty at even higher levels. So something that really affects children especially.
Now, is there any direct tie-in between these worsening statistics about wealth and poverty in the country, linking it directly to the policies of the Bush administration?
Well, there's a lot of political rules that have led to this place, one of the most striking of which is that we haven't seen a raise in the minimum wage in 7 years. We seem to be running this country with an eye towards how we can keep the wealthiest from ever having any cap on what they have, that they should have unlimited abundance. We tell stories about chief executive officers that they created all the wealth of their companies and therefore they deserve very large fortunes. And at the same time, we tell stories about those lower on the economic ladder that if they get a raise, they'll bankrupt the economy and send us all out of work. And that's simply not true. It didn't happen last time we raised the minimum wage. Unemployment continued to go down. The economy continued to be strong. And there's a lot of examples and studies that have been done in cities that have adopted living wages of higher levels and finding that there's been no adverse impact on the economy. So while chief executive officers got a 9% raise last year, and the average employee in America got a 2% raise, those who work at minimum wage, and there's more than 10 million adults working full-time at minimum wage, they haven't had a raise since 1997.
Now, statistics like this seem to me to be very important and certainly with critical relevance to the upcoming presidential election. But I think if you were to tap somebody on the shoulder walking down the street anywhere in this country, they would really have no idea about this worsening situation. They may have a general feeling, but they don't know specifically about the polarization, the economic polarization. Why do you think that is? Is the news media in this country doing a good job in getting this information into the hands and in the heads of people who are going to be voting this November?
I don't think they are. I think that the news media is increasingly focused on showing us snapshots of daily wealth. We're much more aware of where the Dow Jones average or the S&P average is and where the capacity of a few individuals to increase their wealth, how they stand. But we haven't told the story of the broader society and our cohesiveness and what's happening to a democracy that's increasingly controlled by moneyed interests, both corporate and individual. These are the stories that aren't getting through.
Scott Klinger, as you look towards the election, how important will economic issues be in the election campaign that we're in the final stretch of right now? Has either George W. Bush or John Kerry done enough to spotlight economic problems, economic issues, the disparity in wealth and poverty to your liking?
I don't think either of them has done enough. I think the theme of this election is security, and obviously we know it's international security, but the thing that people aren't talking enough about is economic security. People are feeling more and more squeezed. In fact, the U.S. middle class, the great middle class that has made this country distinct as an economy and as a place that people want to come to in the world, is shrinking. We now have the second smallest middle class among all of the industrialized countries. Only Russia's is smaller, and most people are falling into the more vulnerable classes. A few people are making it into the upper class, but we're really becoming a much more divided country and less cohesive society. And no one's really laid that out.
That was Scott Klinger, co-director of United for a Fair Economy's Responsible Wealth Project. Contact UFE at area code 617-423-2148 or visit their website at www.faireconomy.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio, and where you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Archibald Curry, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.